From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, an unusual and perhaps illuminating moment came during hearings in a case against a Boeing subsidiary accused of helping the CIA to secretly transport terror suspects to overseas prisons where they were tortured. The Bush administration had sought to have the case dismissed under the state secrets privilege, which lets the government ask judges to withhold evidence, even throw out whole cases, because, they argue, the cases might endanger national security. Now, with the Obama administration in power, the government is still trying to have the case thrown out, which led one judge to ask the administration's lawyer, quote, "The change in administration has no bearing?" "No, Your Honor," the lawyer replied. The moment was unusual because judges almost never acknowledge the world of politics. And it may be illuminating because it's an early sign that the new administration's approach to secrecy might not be so new after all. Dahlia Lithwick is Slate's legal columnist. She says prior to the Bush administration, the state secrets privilege was used a lot less often by the government.
It had only ever been invoked 55 times since 1953. Under the Bush administration, it was invoked 39 times. So there was this massive expansion in the amount of times they invoked it. The other difference was how it was used. It went from being this very narrow evidentiary rule, which essentially said, okay, there's a document you can't see. Suddenly it became, you have to dismiss the entire case. This case never goes into a courtroom. It's decided right here and now in the pleading stage because there's just too much of a risk that the information will get out there. And this was used to dismiss some really incredibly important cases under the Bush administration, including several cases that alleged torture had happened, cases that alleged NSA eavesdropping was unconstitutional. So in these very, very high-stakes arenas, the entire case never saw the inside of a courtroom.
So along comes the Obama administration, and in the first opportunity to make a statement, declined to do so.
This Obama administration that was very much for transparency, that had signed executive orders doing away with extraordinary rendition, signed executive orders demanding new transparency in government. Everybody, I think, expected them to come in and say, okay, this doctrine is goofy. We're not going to stand behind it. And instead, the attorney for the Obama administration got up and said, we're going to seek to have this case dismissed on the same grounds, on the grounds of state secrets being divulged. So really no change at all in the position from the Bush era to the Obama era.
And a lot of people are watching this and going, what have we just witnessed? And you posit some theories as to why the administration acted the way it did.
Right. And I'm one of many people. I think the most obvious one is that they just didn't have time to get it together on this. At the same moment that they were saying, we're going to go forward and assert this state secrets privilege, Eric Holder was announcing a review of every case in which the state secrets privilege was being invoked to make sure it was being done for proper reasons. So clearly they want to look at this very closely. Maybe they just haven't had time to look at this particular case. That's one theory. The other thing I posited that's sort of grim is that while they're very, very happy to do away with Bush-era policies that are clearly egregious, things like torture, things like rendition, they kind of like the Bush-era legal theories that give them more executive branch secrecy. Suddenly, once it's you holding the reins of power, all that executive authority starts to look really attractive. And just one other theory that I put out there is that I think that the Obama administration is on the horns of a real dilemma in terms of this problem that they face of investigating past lawlessness in the Bush administration. They've made it very clear that they're just not that interested in going after people who authorized torture or who conducted torture. I think they think it would rip the country apart if they engaged in this kind of inquiry.
There are a couple of other possibilities, of course, to explain the administration's actions. One might be a kind of diplomatic pickle that they found themselves in with regard to the other countries that participated in these renditions. And another is simply that maybe there is, in this case, a state secret that does need to be protected, that it's not just a question of saving the country from embarrassment, but there was something in the particulars that really does get to sources and methods or something else that for national security reasons has to be suppressed. Isn't that one of the possibilities?
There seems to be no dispute that there is a very, very complex set of diplomatic foot races that are going on here. And we saw a British court redacting parts of an opinion about similar issues very recently. As to the second piece, this is a tough case to say that there are a lot of secrets left. I mean, one of the things that the ACLU has argued is much of this stuff is already known. And then certainly the complicity of Jepson, the Boeing subsidiary that was really at issue in this case, there's evidence that they had already admitted that they were flying these torture flights. And what the ACLU is saying in this case is it makes absolutely no sense to say something is secret, have it widely reported, and the only place you can't discuss it is in front of the federal judiciary.
Okay, now there may yet be another shoe to drop in this case because it's being heard in the San Francisco Ninth Circuit Court, a liberal court historically. And there's always the possibility that the judge will look at the representatives of the administration and say, no, sorry, no state secrets here.
That is possible. And I also have to point out that in both the House and the Senate this week, legislation was put forward that would also do a lot to curb the expansive view of the state secrets doctrine. So whether it happens in a courtroom or whether it happens legislatively, I think we might be witnessing the last gasp of the state secrets doctrine, at least as it was conceived by the Bush administration.
Dahlia, thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate and author of its Jurisprudence column.
According to a Gallup poll this week, 80% of the American people either approve or strongly approve of the president's economic stimulus plan. Among those who disagree, a public policy group called Free Press, which said that $44 billion should be allocated to broadband internet alone to get us competitive with the rest of the world, as opposed to the $6 billion now in the bill. Slate columnist Farhad Manju wrote about the tech infrastructure part of the stimulus wish list, and he agrees that there's not much to love in the infrastructure we currently have.
It's not great. Many other countries have better, faster, cheaper broadband internet than we do. Many other countries have electronic health records.
By many, you mean most countries who are living in the modern age.
Yeah, pretty much everyone in the modern age has better internet than we do.
Another big tech topic in the bill refers to computerizing medical records. Who's pushing so hard on this one, and why is it such a big deal?
Yeah, this is something that many health advocacy groups and others have been talking about for more than a decade. The idea is that we would have our health records on a network where they would be transferable to other doctors, where your insurance company would have access to it, and presumably by looking at many different patients' records, the insurance companies would be able to determine what drugs to sort of cover or not cover. Researchers could get access to it. And it would also, people say, reduce medical errors, which supposedly kills thousands of patients every year. But putting it into operation is a huge infrastructure project that involves getting lots of hospitals, lots of insurance companies, and many other parts of the health bureaucracy online and all talking together.
How much money is in the bill for computerizing the medical records?
It's about $20 billion.
Another piece of the technological part of the stimulus package is a plan to upgrade America's electric grid. What are we talking about here?
The plans call for modernizing it, for adding sensors all throughout the grid that would give utility companies and others a better handle on who's using power, where they would be able to shut off power and reroute it to different places that need it. And it would also allow sort of a two-way infrastructure. So if you have at your house some kind of renewable energy source, solar or some kind of fuel cell or something, you could add it to the grid. You would get credited for that. There are many as yet unimagined power generation technologies that people will be able to add to this, and basically we'll have a much more vibrant power grid than we do now.
Now, you argue that one problem with the high-tech part of the stimulus plan is that a lot of people are calling for spending at the deployment level rather than on the research level. I guess they think that the research has gone far enough. You don't think so.
Basically, all of the things that we use today, from computers to the internet to video games, the government played some part in funding the research of those technologies, so at the very early stages. But when the government funds technology at a much later stage, we often see many problems with how that technology develops, and lots of times it doesn't work.
Can you give me some examples where the government jumped in to implement technologies and things went wrong?
The FBI has been working on a computer system for the longest time that doesn't really work. The IRS's computers. A few years ago, the Census Bureau had a big contract to change over its data collectors from using clipboards to using electronic PDAs. They're still going to be using clipboards in 2010.
All right, fair enough. So what are you saying to those high-tech advocates who say, more, more, let's put our money where our mouth is, let's build that system? Are you telling them to hold off and shut up?
It would be great if we had amazing broadband and electronic health records and smart power grid. But I think that having sort of one big contract to do these things, or having the government send out billions of dollars for one program, you're often putting all your eggs in one basket. A better way to do it is to do it the way Silicon Valley has done it for a long time, and the way the government does it at the research level, which is to send out a lot of money to a lot of different ideas, what's called the angel investor model, and see which ones flourish, see which ones work for a while, and then continue to fund only those successful ones. So you do this in the expectation that a lot of ideas will fail, but some of the ideas that do succeed will be great successes.
So how does this plan of yours stack up against what's going on in the stimulus bill? There isn't any venture capital fund in there, is there?
No, there isn't really. And the way I advocate for the money to be parceled out is a much slower way to do it. I think there's something inherently difficult about the stimulus bill, which is we want to do great things, we want to have great advances, but we also want to do it very quickly. And you can do things well or you can do them quickly, but you can't often do them both at the same time.
Thank you very much, Farhad.
Thanks a lot.
Farhad Manju is the technology columnist for Slate and author of True Enough, Learning to Live in a Post-Fact Society.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When it comes to serious investigative reporting of criminal activity, news organizations have traditionally worked parallel to, not in collaboration with, law enforcement, lest journalists be viewed as agents of the government rather than as independent watchdogs, which is why the NBC series To Catch a Predator, in which Dateline joins with police departments to sting pedophiles, raised so many eyebrows. But it also captivated viewers, and now it seems NBC News is getting more ambitious still, along the lines of To Catch a War Criminal. In December, according to a story in Wednesday's New York Times, a news crew showed up on the campus of Goucher College in Maryland looking for a man they believed to be part of the Rwandan genocide. And once again, the network was not working alone. Former journalist Sanford Unger is president of Goucher College, and he joins me now. Hey, Sandy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob. Good to be with you.
Before we get to the particulars of this incident, tell me, please, about the professor in question, Leopold Munyakazi. How did he get to Goucher? What does he teach? What's his story?
Leopold Munyakazi is a scholar from Rwanda. He came to us through something called the Scholar Rescue Fund. The Scholar Rescue Fund gets applications from many more people than it supports. It screens them and decides whom it will recommend to various colleges and universities to spend a year or two teaching and, in effect, being sponsored because, for one reason or another, wherever they're from around the world, they can't go home because they might be in danger. Goucher College decided for the first time to participate in the Scholar Rescue Fund's efforts this academic year.
Did you have any inkling that Munyakazi was under suspicion for war crimes?
We knew that he was alleged to have quote-unquote controversial views, and that he had given speeches in which he challenged the classic view of events in Rwanda in 1994. He didn't defend any killings of anybody, but he said this was more of a civil war than a genocide. So the question was whether by challenging the view, was this a crime? In our view, having controversial views is a credential for teaching in a college or a university. It's not something we would object to. We had no idea that there was any accusation against him for actually participating in the genocide.
Had this been, I don't know, 60 Minutes, you know, even 25 years ago, it certainly wouldn't have been unusual for a TV news magazine to show up in a kind of ambush interview at the culmination of a long investigation that independently determined that the subject was criminal or in some way up to no good. I mean, that's kind of standard fare. But there was a twist in this case. NBC was not working alone.
Right. NBC News said that they had some concerns about somebody who was working at Goucher who might have been involved in some nefarious activities. And they showed up the next day with the Rwandan prosecutor. I know in your introduction before you said sometimes it appears that the prosecutors are manipulating the media by bringing them along. In this case, I felt like the media were manipulating the prosecutor. You would think if he was coming to this country to finger some alleged war criminals from Rwanda that he would have gone to the Justice Department or the State Department, not typically to a television network. It just didn't inspire confidence that I was dealing with a genuine law enforcement matter, if you know what I mean. I thought I was dealing more with a kind of show, and I guess it is a TV show.
As a former reporter for the Washington Post and host of All Things Considered, I know there must be still a little fire dog in you. Have you not made some inquiries as to try to satisfy yourself as to the particulars of this case?
I attempted to call the equivalent of the Attorney General of Rwanda. I did not get a call or an email back. I made contact by email with the chief prosecutor at the War Crimes Tribunal in Arusha, Tanzania, which until December is where Rwandan war crimes cases were being tried. I learned there was no case against Professor Munyakazi there. I also called a woman named Alison DeForge from Human Rights Watch, who is widely regarded as the international expert on the Rwandan genocide and has testified in Arusha, in Tanzania, on some of those cases. And she had never heard of this case against Professor Munyakazi. And by the way, the indictment was only made known after he had given some of these controversial speeches in the United States.
Now, NBC News has declined to speak to us, but in fairness, I suppose, we should note that what we're discussing here is the sausage making, not the sausage itself, and we have yet to see the results of the reporting. I suppose you will be watching with some interest.
Well, I will. If it ever airs, I'll be watching with some interest to see what NBC has to say. But I'm enough of a veteran of the news business to be a little worried about the techniques they've used to get a story.
All right, Sandy. Well, thank you very much.
Happy to do it.
Sanford Unger is president of Goucher College outside of Baltimore, Maryland.
For years, the coverage of climate change was tinged with a false equivalency. To give the appearance of balance, reporters would devote equal space to a climatologist representing the scientific consensus as they would to a specialist often bankrolled by big oil or big business who denied the existence of global warming or man's role in it. But in the past few years, the coverage has let go of this equivalency, only to replace it with a new one. According to Eric Pooley, former managing editor of Fortune, reporters now offer a false equivalency in covering what to do about global warming. He uses as his case study the coverage of the debate over a defeated cap-and-trade bill, a measure that would have put a cap on greenhouse gas emissions but allow companies that emit less to sell their excess allotment to companies that emit more. Proponents say this would create a profit motive for going green, but groups on either side of the debate have drastically different estimates for how much it would cost. Pooley says that the dueling numbers are mistakenly given equal play by the media.
What I'm arguing is that there's an emerging mainstream economic consensus that doing a well-designed cap-and-trade system won't break the bank. And it's coming out of the academy and coming out of government studies. And it's been completely missed by reporters because reporters are trained to look for balance and they will go and find the spokespeople who say that if we do this, it's going to destroy the economy.
Now, you singled out two pro-business groups as essentially the main opposition to this legislation, the National Association of Manufacturers and the American Council for Capital Formation.
Well, right now they say that putting a cap-and-trade system in place would be disastrous to the American economy. And they feed extremely negative economic assumptions into their economic model, and they come up with very scary doomsday forecasts that gasoline prices will go up to $8 a gallon, 4 million jobs could be destroyed, up to $669 billion can be drained from the U.S. GDP. And those reports are treated with a lot of respect by the mainstream media.
Why shouldn't they be? Are they built on demonstrably false assumptions?
Yes, they are. For example, the National Association of Manufacturers report assumes that between now and 2030, we won't be bringing any more wind power online per year than we did last year. In other words, our transition to clean energy in this country has already peaked. If you have enough assumptions like that, you drive up the costs in your forecast. And reporters don't look under the hood of those reports.
Are you saying that the press, by giving space to the concerns of business groups, actually distorts the truth with the same false equivalency that marred the coverage of global warming for so many years?
The business community absolutely deserves a voice in this debate, and it has one. And it's wrong to think that the business community is monolithically opposed to action. In fact, there's a coalition of business groups called US CAP that's pushing for quick action on climate. It includes companies like GE and Dow and Alcoa. So it's not as if we want to muzzle the business community. All I'm saying is that reporters need to assess the arguments that are being made in a more sophisticated way than they've been doing.
Now, the principal opponent to the positions taken by these business groups would be the Environmental Defense Fund. Do you see any examples of misdirections, lies of their own?
Some of the environmentalists have put out reports that are too rosy. They don't pass the smell test. Environmental Defense did something entirely different last year. They didn't set out to cook up a research study that would support their position. They took the five mainstream academic and governmental models that were already out there, the five consensus best reports that exist, and they averaged them together. And that's how they came up with a report that reminded people that, look, this is affordable and we can do this. Now, that was a good piece of scholarship. That's not to say that they didn't skew it a little bit just in the way they presented the detail, and they overlooked largely the regional impacts of a cap-and-trade system, which would be significant. But if we use the proceeds from a cap-and-trade bill to cushion the impact on consumers, this is still very manageable.
Let's talk about this Environmental Defense Fund meta study for a second. You said that these were, you know, studies by relatively disinterested parties. They were based on their models. But models of this sort are notoriously inaccurate.
You're absolutely right. These models, as I say in my paper, are not crystal balls. EDF said that right up front. You can't believe any one model. That's why they took the five best and put them together to see if there was some sort of rough consensus emerging, and there was. However, what the opponents have been doing is taking one very skewed report and pretending that they do have a crystal ball.
And the Chamber of Commerce, which stands with the National Association of Manufacturers, takes the crystal ball even further into ads in which they see people jogging to work because they can't afford to put gasoline in their cars and people cooking their breakfasts over a candle. And that's potent PR. But you looked at how the media treated these two sets of economic predictions.
We took a sample of 40 stories that explored the cost debate, and we found that seven of them were one-sided on one side or the other. 24 were balanced in a sort of stenographer sense. It was the he said, she said opposition. And the nine stories attempted to play what I call a referee, calling one side or the other if they were playing fast and loose with the facts. And that's my model for how you have to work a very contentious policy debate like this. Reporters aren't getting the time on the beat that they need to master this material. And if you don't master the material, you can't hold the combatants to any sort of standard because they will game you.
So given the problem that people may not stay on these beats as long as they ought to and that they're prey to this he said, she said structure, how do you think news organizations ought to tackle this subject?
The problem is that the climate policy beat requires expertise in science, politics, and business and economics. So it really calls for a team approach. The good news is that the New York Times just created an environmental reporting team that includes all those kinds of reporters. And I think other news organizations should follow suit. Now, of course, what we're seeing is the reverse. CNN just fired its entire 7-person environmental reporting unit. I call this a disposable beat because in the age of slashed newsroom budgets and layoffs, people are getting torn off this beat and thrown at whatever the story of the moment is. And I'm arguing that this is the story of the century here. If a meteor was hurtling toward the Earth, and our best scientists were telling us that we had less than 10 years to destroy or divert it, I can tell you that every news organization worth its salt would be throwing team reporting at that, and they'd be letting their people go very deep and do great enterprise journalism about it. Well, this is the equivalent of that right now, and yet our news organizations aren't responding to it that way.
Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Eric Pooley's paper, How Much Would You Pay to Save the Planet?, was published by Harvard University's Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy. So, reporters could do better. But isn't it also the scientists' responsibility to help distill complex scientific issues for the rest of us? 10 years ago, Jane Lubchenco, Obama's pick to head the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, created the Leopold Leadership Program at Stanford University to sharpen scientists' communication skills. Pam Mattson is the current director. She says scientists have a lot to learn about getting their message across.
Well, I think it's a special problem of scientists because we are taught how to communicate with one audience, and that is our audience, other scientists. We're taught to provide lots of background information. We focus on the details of how we do the research, the uncertainty around our results. And then only at the very end do we talk about the conclusions, the bottom line. And so I think most of us have to be taught to turn that around if we're talking to the public, talking to decision makers of any sort, to put the bottom line up front.
You're trying to get them to talk in inverted pyramids?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So what do you teach them at your program?
First of all, we encourage them to think about who the audience is, to not allow themselves to be invited to speculate on things that they're not comfortable speculating about. And we encourage them to take the time to organize their thoughts. It's surprising that one of the most aha moments is when you realize you can say to a journalist, I'm sorry, I can't talk right now, but what's your deadline? And can I get right back to you about that?
I understand you do simulations.
Yes. The scientists work with real journalists. They practice one-on-one with a microphone in their face to simulate the real situation. Then the journalists give our fellows feedback so that they can improve next time around.
You know, it's often been noted that the culture of science and that of journalism collide over the matter of narrative. That is, reporters crave a story with a beginning and a middle and an end, whereas science is a process, which is why readers can find themselves assaulted with a succession of stories along the lines of coffee is good for you, coffee is bad for you, coffee is good for you. Do you deal with that sort of core cultural conflict?
I don't think that we completely break that culture down, but we spend a lot of time introducing the fellows to the world of journalists to help them understand what constraints they're under, their time constraints, their editing constraints, and so forth.
Now, this is a relatively elite program. Only about 20 fellows go through it each year. How many fellows have you got out there right now?
We have 134 fellows now trained, and we link that network with the best of the scientific journalists in the country so that they become a resource for those journalists. Also, we've developed a set of tools that the fellows can use in training others of their colleagues and their students in their own universities.
You call it a camp. Is it like camp?
Well, the camp plays out in two different ways. We spend 1 week in a retreat environment, and yes, there is a lot of effort towards bonding, building a cohort of fellows who respect and trust each other and can turn to each other. The second part of the camp takes place in Washington, D.C., where our fellows come face-to-face with opportunities to interact with Congress, NGOs, and with business leaders.
So part of this is bonding. How do scientists bond?
Scientists bond in the way anybody else does. We may take a short trip down the river or sit around at night and play games or have a game of soccer or volleyball, just like everybody else.
I don't know. I'm journalists bond by snapping rubber bands at each other. I don't think that's universal.
Oh, no. I've seen journalists bonding as part of the Leopold program. And I'll tell you, those journalists really know how to bond.
Pam, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Pam Mattson is Dean of the School of Earth Sciences at Stanford University and Director of the Leopold Leadership Program.
Coming up, the anniversary of a famous fatwa, and how much do you have to know about religion to report on America?
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On February 14th, 1989, Iran's leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini, issued a funny Valentine, a death sentence in the form of a religious edict called a fatwa against author Salman Rushdie. The alleged crime was blasphemy against Islam in Rushdie's book, The Satanic Verses. Protests erupted in England and around the world.
The official aim of this march is to extend the law of blasphemy, get the Satanic Verses banned, and have its author put on trial. But many of the demonstrators demand instant and final retribution.
In the days just following the issuing of the fatwa, Rushdie turned to his lawyer, Jeffrey Robertson, for legal and physical protection, hiding out, among other places, in Robertson's home. When the fatwa first came down, Robertson says they had no idea how seriously to take it, but soon they realized just how grave the situation was.
What made it deeply serious, I think, was when the government-backed so-called charity put a price on Salman's head, actually announced a bounty of about $3 million for killing him. That really was quite worrying.
The police rather liked your home as a safe house. Tell me why.
It was in Islington in North London, and it overlooked a church and church grounds and a park, so they could see pretty clearly any would-be assassin advancing on it, and it was blocked at the back, so it was a good place to hide out.
Now, this case took a rather bizarre twist when your client was sued in British court for the crime of blasphemy, which until recently was, you know, on the books in the UK.
It was a crime. It has a dreadful history. A lot of Tom Paine's works were condemned for blasphemy, and booksellers who sold them in the early 19th century were sent to most brutal prisons. It was revived in the 1970s because there was a paper called Gay News that published a poem that envisaged Christ as gay, and that was far too much for these Anglican obsessives. They reinvented the crime of blasphemy to punish the editor of Gay News. And so some Muslim lawyers decided that they would flush Salman out of hiding by issuing a summons for a criminal offense. But they had to get a magistrate to issue a summons, and the magistrate refused. So they had to go to the High Court to argue that the summons should be issued.
But the judge turned down the summons because, at least under the British law, blasphemy was considered only in terms of the Church of England, correct?
Correct. It wasn't a crime to blaspheme against Islam. And so they appealed on that basis, not a bad basis. If we'd had a Bill of Rights in those days, as you do, we would either have sensibly struck down the whole law or at least extended it to protect every religion. But they failed, partly because, of course, they had to work out what it was about the book, about the satanic verses, that actually blasphemed. And, of course, they couldn't.
I want to come back to the British blasphemy law, since repealed. What finally forced that to happen was the case in Sudan, where a British subject was accused of blasphemy for naming her teddy bear in a way deemed disrespectful to Islam, which put the world in high dudgeon until it was pointed out that the West has blasphemy laws too, correct?
It was pretty obvious that the blasphemy laws, particularly one that protected only the Anglican religion, were indefensible. It was very uncomfortable for the British government to be told, well, you have your blasphemy laws, we have ours. So I think finally the message got home to the government, and eventually last year they abolished the blasphemy law.
Okay, so that's been repealed. The fatwa against Salman Rushdie has not been repealed. Can you explain why that is?
Well, I'm no Islamic legal scholar. I'm told that because the Ayatollah is no longer with us, it can't be posthumously withdrawn. But others say that it can. The state of Iran disclaims the bounty that was there. So we could hope that it's just become a dead letter.
Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Robertson is a human rights lawyer and author of the books Tyrannicide Brief and Crimes Against Humanity. And now religious misunderstanding of another sort. Listen to President Barack Obama at his inaugural address, paraphrasing a passage from 1 Corinthians.
We remain a young nation, but in the words of Scripture, the time has come to set aside childish things.
He made a point of attributing it to Scripture. Had he not, many in the audience, including many reporters, might not have recognized the biblical reference. That journalists too often don't get religion is the subject of a new book, Blind Spot, which seeks to describe how the media missed the mark on stories from the war on terror to the 2004 presidential campaign to human rights. In the foreword to Blind Spot, former Bush speechwriter Michael Gerson states that, quote, a journalism that ignores or dismisses the role of religion in our common life misses the greatest stories of our time.
You know, I come from a more conservative religious background. There is a certain caricature of evangelical and fundamentalist political involvement, which sometimes is justified, you know, a moral majority view. I think that a lot of the media, for example, has missed the fact that there's a large movement going on within American conservative Christianity that has to do with other social justice issues, particularly human trafficking, where it was really a religious coalition that brought this to the forefront of American foreign policy. Things like Sudan, the North-South Agreement in Sudan, which was pushed by a specifically religious coalition involving many evangelicals. Things like advocacy on AIDS and malaria, those are increasingly religious causes motivated in our foreign policy by religious ideals and approaches. Not recognizing the trends and complexity of some of religious life in America would obscure some of those stories. I'll also mention one other thing. I think one of the great missed stories of our time is this extraordinary historical change, which is the movement of the center of gravity of world Christianity to the global south. There are now more evangelicals in Brazil and Nigeria combined than there are in the United States. There are now more Presbyterians in Ghana than there are in Scotland. This is a huge event. And if you didn't take religion seriously, you'd miss that story.
But it struck me that the focus of your book was rather not on the coverage of religion per se, but the coverage of everything else by those who don't understand the subtle and sometimes not so subtle effect of faith on what happens around us.
No, I agree with that. I did the introduction for this book. There are many other authors in it who are making the case not that we need more religious reporters, but that we need all reporters to be more knowledgeable about religion. One of the case studies that's used in the book, which I think is quite effective, is the case of the coverage of someone like John Paul II. you know, he was a major world leader that participated in the end of the Cold War, was deeply involved in the transformation of his own church, was one of the largest figures of the 20th century. But he tended, by many reporters, to be interpreted entirely through the lens of American ideological debate. So he was either a conservative or a liberal. When in fact, the comprehensive and fascinating thought of John Paul II violated those categories fundamentally and was not generally understood. Because many reporters didn't really understand Roman Catholic social teaching, I think they misunderstood the essential role that John Paul II played. That's one of the arguments of the book, and I think it shows the broader implications of some of these failures.
We began this conversation by quoting Obama's quotation of Scripture. He felt, or his speechwriters felt, that he had to explicitly mention that it was a scriptural passage. When you wrote for President Bush, it has been said that you were actually able to go right past the media elites, to avoid the media filter, and speak in a kind of scriptural code directly to the president's base. Is that true?
No. The reality here is it's not a code. It's our culture. It's the common rhetorical heritage of our country. When Abraham Lincoln said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand," it was part of the New Testament. When Ronald Reagan used "a city on a hill," it's from the part of the New Testament in red. And the reality here is that it's not necessarily the president's fault when you use references that should be common cultural references. I'll give you one example. And this was not a speech that was written. It was just the way the president talks. During the campaign in the 2000 election, he mentioned during an interview that it was important to take the log out of your own eye before you take the speck out of your neighbor's eye. The reporter in the New York Times, who was a very good guy, thought it was a gaffe and called it, in the front page in the New York Times, an interesting variation on the pot calling the kettle black. He didn't know the reference. Neither did any of his editors at the New York Times. These are words of Jesus from the New Testament that would be familiar to most Americans. This is the way that presidents have always communicated. And by the way, it's the way that Barack Obama, in that great tradition, communicated in his own inaugural by using scriptural references. And not just that one, but talking about still waters, for example, which has a marvelous biblical resonance. You know, I don't think that's a plot. I think that that's American rhetoric.
So somewhere around the 80s, newsrooms began to figure out that in covering civil rights and every other aspect of American politics and society, that it was not enough to be well-meaning, that you had to have diversity, racial diversity on the staff. Otherwise, you were essentially tone-deaf to a lot of the major issues that you were reporting on day-to-day. Mm-hmm. By the same token, should newspapers be doing diversity outreach for people of faith or at least scriptural literacy?
Well, I'm not sure that we're going to see or that I would even support evangelical quotas at the major newspapers of the country. I don't think that would necessarily be appropriate. I think this is a matter of good reporters understanding the deepest motivations of many of their fellow citizens and not dismissing them. This is not a secular country. It's not even a secular government. We don't establish religion. We don't favor sectarian groups, but we're inclusive of all traditions. And that's the attitude, I think, that reporters should take. Not that we scrub our public discourse of religious ideas and references, that is somehow neutrality. That's not neutrality. It's silence.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Gerson was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. He wrote the foreword for the recently published book, Blind Spot, When Journalists Don't Get Religion.
If the beliefs, or lack thereof, of journalists can affect their reporting, what happens when reporting takes a toll on their beliefs? That's what happened to LA Times religion reporter Bill Lobdell. A born-again Christian, he lobbied hard for the religion beat at the LA Times. He eventually got his wish, only to lose his faith in the church and in God in the process. In his new book, Losing My Religion, Lobdell frankly lays out that loss. He spoke to us in 2007, and he told us he turned to religion during a tough time in his life. His marriage was on shaky ground. He just had his first child. He needed some guidance, and on the advice of a friend, he went to church.
I fell in love with the church, God, everything else. Ended up going on a religious retreat. And at the end of that weekend, I felt God actually coming into my heart. I actually felt it. It seemed like it was a tangible thing. And I felt that I'd become a born-again Christian.
And was it at that point that you began to feel that the mainstream media coverage of religion was inadequate or basically wrongheaded?
It was. I thought oftentimes that newspapers and the media in general treated religion like a freak show. Journalists didn't think people were serious about their faith. And if they were serious about their faith, there's something very odd about them.
You were moved to try and convince your editors at the LA Times to give you a shot at the religion beat. And by 2002, you were covering the Catholic Church sex abuse stories around the country. You were going to church twice a week, and you were taking conversion classes in order to become a Catholic. What was that like?
That was very tough. I interviewed literally hundreds of victims. I interviewed lying bishops. I interviewed their lawyers, and it was really tough to reconcile this church that I saw as being something great and something that I wanted to enter and what I was seeing in my day-to-day work.
I know that one of your spiritual mentors told you that, look, this isn't about the church. This is about flawed human beings. You can still maintain your faith in the church, but you didn't think so.
Well, they said, you know, keep your eyes on the man on the cross, not the person behind the altar. And that's true. And I get that this is human failing. But the problem is, for me, I thought the church and any religious institution should be somehow better than Enron or a corrupt government. In some ways, it was worse.
So on Good Friday in 2002, after a year of conversion courses, you decided not to convert to Catholicism. But even after that, even after you stopped going to church, Bill, you still maintained a belief in God. Eventually, that was also lost. What happened?
I think my mind caught up with my heart. My faith had been chipped away at through stories and through what I saw. It's something that I really, really didn't want to give up. And so I held on to it. I tried some spiritual counseling. I did try to double down on my prayer life. None of it worked. The final blow came in a Portland courtroom. It was a hearing for a mother whose child was sick. She was trying to get more child support from the child's dad, who happened to be a Catholic priest. And she really lived a miserable life. She lived in a friend's basement for free. They got food from the food bank. And the priest was on the stand. He had a great lawyer, just the sharpest attorney. She couldn't afford one. And his defense was, I took a vow of poverty and I don't have any money to give. I saw the mom being crushed by this machine. And I sat there in the courtroom and I wasn't surprised. I kind of lost that sense of outrage even. And at that point, I realized I just don't believe any of this stuff anymore. And I called my wife on the cell phone and just said, I need to get off this religion beat. It's over.
You wrote at the end of the piece, I saw now that belief in God, no matter how grounded, requires at some point a leap of faith. Either you have the gift of faith or you don't. So, Bill, do you think you would have lost your faith if you hadn't been reporting on religion?
I don't know. I think that I was in a unique position. I saw things other people don't really see. I used to think faith was a choice. It's like going down a street. You're going to go this street or that street. Which way are you going to pick? But for me, it became very clear internally. I just didn't believe. It was like a light switch went off. And I could fake it, but it wasn't there anymore.
Do you wish you'd never asked for the beat?
No, I'm glad. It's been a tough road, but I'm glad I unless I go to hell when I die, I'm glad that...
Wait a minute. I thought you don't believe in that stuff anymore.
Well, you know, it's always it'd be nice to hedge on the other side, you know, if you're going to hedge one way or another. But no, I don't believe in that stuff anymore. I just hope to God, that's the baddest thing, but I hope to God I'm right.
It's a hard habit to break, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Bill, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Bill Lobdell is the author of Losing My Religion, How I Lost My Faith, Reporting on Religion in America, and Found Unexpected Peace.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Wallo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.